Well, hello, friends. Welcome to the 75th webinar on the Secret Doctrine.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Good. You know, it says Francis's secret programs on the marquee.
Well, that's hilarious. I wish they weren't so secret. Maybe more people would come.
Well, it's on the Moria Federation thing because I click on that because I don't have to put a number in. And it says Francis's secret programs.
That's because it's both of them. It's the same link for the secret teaching of all ages and the secret doctrine. So
that was pretty funny.
Right. And I have many other secret programs that are too secret to reveal to you. So
Okay.
Okay. As you all know by now, this webinar series is available on makara.us under the subheadings Moria Federation webinars, then webinar series in progress, as shown here. All episodes of this, these Secret Teachings of All Ages and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar series you'd like to view. You can also access any of these webinars on the homepage of MoriaFederation.com. Up in the left-hand corner, you have, this is an old screenshot, but I need to update this. But in the, up in this upper left, any webinar series that's currently in progress is shown there. Okay. This month in Old Diary Leaves, Colonel Olcott muses about HPB's abilities to transcribe the ageless wisdom from her unseen masters. So could we get a reader for this, please?
I'll start.
Okay.
In her letter to me, Olcott, HPB cites the fact of Mr. Z having sat with her for hours while she was transcribing what was spoken to her audience sense by a master, invisible to him, Mr. Z, but seen by herself. The reader will find in the second volume of this series my description of her method of writing from the dictation of an invisible teacher, as I myself saw it at Buddha Command. This very same thing I saw unnumbered times while she was writing Isis Unveiled. I have described it exactly as it occurred and quoted her own description of the process in a letter to her sister. It agrees perfectly with what she writes me as having occurred at Ostende. Shall we call this phenomenon plagiarism then, or shall we not modestly confess our ignorance of that most awe-inspiring fact of the transmission of thought vibration from spiritual man to physical man, of its laws, its limitations, and its potentialities?
Thank you, BL. New reader, please.
Yvonne, can you read that, please?
Sure. The Overland Mail of August the 12th brought me the news that without the shadow of constitutional authority, HPB had cabled our people in New York, offering to turn over her share of the Theosophist to Judge and to make him her successor. What a pity that one cannot collect into one letter the many similar offers she has made to men and women from first to last. To offer anyone the successorship was as liberal and practical as to offer him a farm on the moon, for she never could have a real successor for the simple reason that nobody was ever likely to be born just like her and so fill her place. At the same time, Mrs. Besant has proved that it is possible for another to create as commanding a place as hers was and to do as much as she to spread theosophy throughout the world. Still, there is one glory of the sun and another glory of the moon and another glory of the stars. And so, while there can be no more than one HPB sun, nor one Annie Besant moon, There are places in our sky for hosts of stars, which certainly differ from each other in glory. And if Judge had only realized that.
Thank you. Yeah, there's one place in the six-volume set of old diary leaves where Colonel Olcott describes watching HPB while she's receiving transmission from the Masters. And they so completely overshadowed her that during one session, she was stroking her beard. Of course, she doesn't have a beard, but she was stroking the beard of the Invisible Master on her own face as she was writing. And then she quickly looked up, saw that Olcott was watching her, and quit stroking her invisible beard. I thought that told a lot about just how immersed she was in this transmission. Okay. We started our last session with a look at the quote, holy youths who refused to multiply and create species after their likeness. This refers to the Manasaputras, solar angels, who chose not to overshadow animal man and the early fourth subrace of the third root race because they hadn't yet developed their own vehicles enough to have their monastic principles stimulated. The equipment wasn't developed enough. But the delay, this refusal to overshadow them came at a cost, for it led to procreation with the animal kingdom. We've been talking about this for the last few webinars. And the subsequent creation of what HPB calls anthropoids, which were half animal, half human creatures, who must first be conditioned on subtler planes before they can be brought into the human kingdom at a future time. We then reviewed verse 5, that finished verse 5, and we reviewed it, during which time we took a look at a passage from the second volume of the Secret Doctrine on the true reason that the Manasaputras refused to overshadow early third root race animal man. And I think it's important enough to reread. Quote, but agreeably to esoteric interpretation, refusing to create was actually a self-sacrifice for the benefit of mankind. The quote-unquote rebels would not create will-less, irresponsible men as the obedient angels did, nor could they endow human beings with only the temporary reflections of their own attributes, for even the latter, belonging to another and so much higher plane of consciousness, would leave man still irresponsible, hence interfere with any possibility of a higher progress, suggesting that consciousness cannot be bestowed, but must be developed over a period of millions of years, and must be, in fact, earned through one's own evolutionary progress. I see a hand.
Please go ahead, Ariane.
I'm so sorry, but I'm totally lost. So I'm wondering if I could ask a series of questions.
Go for it.
Yeah, it's from last class. I just to continue on, and I'm not an expert in the books, but just to say that, first of all, in Egyptian iconography, you see the half animal head and the human body. Is this referring to?
Okay. No, that's a totally different use of the symbolism. There, what's happening is the particular potencies that are associated with different animals, for instance, the power and dominance of the lion, and also the rays associated with the lion, first and fifth, sometimes a second, demonstrated through a particular God, and you know, what's the God's name? Goddess's name, Sekhmet. Sekhmet is the goddess that has a lion's head and a female body, which interestingly suggests the merging of Virgo and Leo. Also, the Sphinx has just the reverse. It has a woman's head and a lion's body, again, suggesting the merging of that sign, which at one point, those two signs were one sign. So it has a very different connotation than what's being described here.
I thought that the Sphinx was the fact that it shows that what depicted the fact that it was created a much earlier time than is assumed, that it occurred during the constellation of Leo, and that why it was depicted as such. Leo pointed to it.
There are many theories about when it came into being. It's most of the theories are based on where what are now called the air vents, which are really channels of observation. What they are is little square, they're about, I don't know, 6-inch square tunnels that penetrate into the queen's chamber. And you can, viewing from those gave you a very particular view of the heavens, basically one star in the center. And what they've done is they've been able to figure out when certain prominent stars were visible through those what are now called air shafts. They were never air shafts. They're way too long to get any real circulation going. And have determined the antiquity of the pyramid in that way. And that of course is based on the precession of the equinoxes in terms of which stars would appear in those long observation tunnels.
I understand. Those are astronomical instruments. So the second question is about the anthropoids. Are these like the Cro-Magnon man and
no.
The kind of what are these anthropoids? Are they us? What are they?
Yeah, we've talked about them in previous webinars. They're a name that HPB gave to half animal, half men. The way the story goes is that in the early part of the third subrace of the third root race, humanity started procreating. In other words, they were no longer what were called egg-born or a direct emanation from the lunar lords. They were literally procreating themselves. And at this time, the refusal came that here are called the rebels, those Manasaputras who refused to overshadow man because they weren't yet ready. But what happened as a result of that is some members of humanity procreated with a now long extinct form of animal. They called the she, what were they called? The she mammals or something. And of course that's no longer possible. But in that early, early time, now we're talking, you know, more than 21 million years ago, these female animals then gave birth to what HPB dubs anthropoid, which are half animal, half men. Well, by right, these creatures, belonged to the human kingdom because they had an element of humanity in them. So this became the karmic responsibilities of those Manasaputras that refused to overshadow man, because if they had, supposedly there wouldn't have been this wrongful procreation. So that's kind of the background on that. Does that help?
Yes, that's a little bit helpful. The question would be then, we are all animal men in this room. We're
Ariane, you're breaking up. Can you get closer to your mic or click out and come back in or something?
Yeah. Yes. Can you hear me better now?
Yes.
I'm so sorry. We are human animal men in this room. We're all, by definition, animal men.
No. Not a theosophical definition. Yes, I can see where the confusion is. You know, yes, we're kind of a combination of third and fifth kingdom. The fourth kingdom is really a kind of a combination between the third and fifth kingdom, in fact, right? But what's meant as animal man in this context is that specific result of the procreation between the no longer existing animal of that far gone time and the humanity of that time.
And was this done sexually? I mean, in other words,
yes.
The beings who wanted to, these beings were like on the etheric plane only, and then they wanted to take a physical form. And that's how they reached out to these she animals to perform that. And these she animals already existed on the planet Earth.
They both were physical, not just etheric. This was physical procreation, as we now procreate. But at that time, it was possible for animals and man and humankind to have sexual intercourse and result in offspring. Unfortunately, because then it resulted in this byproduct, you could say, that has to gradually be incorporated into the human kingdom through a very special process, which involves them residing in the higher levels of the elemental kingdom for a time, and then gradually brought in after purification into a future root race in a future round. But they will come into the human kingdom way before that gate opens for animals, for other animals, you know, such as domestic animals.
Okay. So are these beings something that we could recognize now? Like, are these beings living amongst us or not?
No, they're out of form. They're on other planes, being, you could say, processed, for lack of a better word, in order to align them with their true nature, which is the human, and purify them of that animal nature, the animal kingdom quality, the animal kingdom nature. It's funny.
Thank you so much. Yeah, you're very welcome.
I appreciate the questions. You know, anytime anybody asks a question like this, there's another 10 people that don't know. And maybe in this case, a lot more than that, you know, because we've explored this, but sometimes the language can be very archaic. So I appreciate giving me the opportunity to articulate this better. Okay.
Sorry, Greg, I saw that you'd lowered your hand, but it's up again. So please go ahead.
Okay. I guess in a speculative way, relating to this animal man thing, I think it's related to, as Francis was talking about, the Lemurian and Atlantean root races that then were brought forth by Sanat Kumara, who came and then brought the fire of the mind to the Lemurian, and in part that was also happening in the Atlantean, but that in itself carried forward And in a sense, these animal men are, in a sense, this is just speculative, that they're kind of like our ancestry, pre-human.
This is a different use of the term animal man. Animal man in the context that you're describing is correct, but it relates to the form aspect of humankind. Before they were overshadowed by Manasaputras or the soul, and therefore stimulating the manasic principle, mind, right? This, what I'm talking about here with Arayan, is a kind of anomaly where actual half animal, half men were produced. You could say, to be really correct, it would be half animal man and half animal were created in the last half of the third subrace of the third root race before the Manasaputras overshadowed man. And that created this anomaly that HPB calls the anthropoid. So there are two different uses of the term animal man. And I also appreciate that you brought this up, because it's easy to confuse those. You know, the usual use of the term animal man relates to that period of humankind before they were overshadowed by Manasaputras and given the spark of mind, not to what we're talking about here, which is this half animal, half man. Okay, so it's very confusing. Anyone else?
Pia said something along the lines of Greg, who says, thanks for the clarification. Anyway, she says, it may be helpful to research the discussion around ancient Lemuria and the sin of the mindless.
That's what it is, the sin of the mindless. That's exactly what's being referred to. Thank you for that term. That, you know, any way of describing it helps us get a picture in our head. So that's another way of describing this time of where this situation took place. See another hand?
Yes. Yvonne, please go ahead.
Well, maybe you might like to mention the progeny of that, the half human, half the animals that we have today, the anthropoids, such as, you know, the chimpanzee and the...
It's not the same. It's not the same. They are not descended from animal man, from the what HPB calls the anthropoids. They are they're not the same. HPB specifically says that, by the way. It's not just an opinion I have. It's she specifically says what we call now anthropoids or primates have no direct connection with this. Really, what was that phrase? You know, about the sin. What was the phrase?
Mindless.
The sin of the mindless, wasn't that something like that? Yeah, the sin of the mindless. It has no direct connection. So if these are all really good clarifications. Okay, so there is no animal on Earth connected with that ancient phenomenon of that HPB terms the anthropoid, okay? Which is itself a different use of that term than is currently in use, you know, the scientific term anthropoid. Okay, is it starting to get clear? Anyone else?
That's it for now. Gordon's got his hand up. Go ahead, please, Gordon.
So in this quote here, the rebels did not create willless, irresponsible men as the obedient angels did. So what does that mean that the obedient angels did?
Okay, there are classes of Manasaputras. The highest class is called Asuras. The means no. So no Sura meaning form, no form, completely formless. So they're at a very high levels. They were the quote unquote rebels. But this is just from a certain perspective. That is, we're going to be talking about this during this, but I'll just answer this question as briefly as I can now, and with some clarity, which is the law of involution requires that these beings who were free from the burden of incarnation assist those who had not yet attained that stage, and therefore they overshadowed. Those were the obedient angels. In other words, that was the law of the time, this involutional I want to call it wave trend tendency. It was like a flow of energy that directed everything towards the material. It wasn't some being who said, okay, you guys, you have to do this. Nothing like that. It was just this great wave towards manifestation. And the obedient angels followed that law of manifestation. The rebels chose not to. And for exerting that individual choice, they're called, this is what was later called the war in heaven, where they chose not to overshadow humanity. And we're going to be talking about them, so I'm not going to be describing them much further than that. But they are two classes of Deva, basically. And the higher class are the ones that chose to do other work that would eventually, that would in fact actually help humanity. Part of the reasons described here, had they overshadowed them, they would have created a kind of automaton humanity, hence interfering with any possible higher progress. Why? Because the progress has to be self-initiated. It can't be done for us. So that was the reason given here. But there's, to me, an even more convincing reason that is described, and we're going to be getting into it. Yes, Ariana.
I hope this isn't too far off the mark, but basically, in Alice Bailey's books that I read too long ago to remember distinctly, about the fact that there is this quote unquote the Jewish problem, and I don't want to offend anyone here, I'm Jewish, so I please forgive me if I do, but that the Jews were like a race that were from an earlier round of the moon or something, and that they didn't graduate. There was something that happened that held them back, maybe their material focus. And then I would like some correction and clarification about that, because and also I want to understand what is the Jews' relationship in incarnation to like the Asians and the Aryan races. Are they the same? So that's my question. It's sort of related, because it sounds like some beings just mechanically of the higher realms mechanically were driven towards involution, you're saying, that like the obedient angels, and they just mechanically or almost passively followed the thrust of materiality, whereas these others refused to abide by that, stating that that it was for the good of humanity, because humanity shouldn't have been endowed with such powers before they were ready and capable to embody them. I want to understand that, because there seems to be some kind of overlap. And then I have a secondary question, if I can hold it in mind, because things are probably not.
Well, the quote unquote Jewish problem doesn't really relate to what we're talking about here. This doesn't have to do with these two classes of devas at all. The Jewish as a race, and by the way, any of us can be born into the Jewish, I would call it a energetic field that has an effect on those of us that pass into it and through it. But it's not a race in the sense like the Caucasian or the other Asian races at all. It's more a cultural, quote unquote, race, right? They're ruled very much by the third ray, and you're right in saying that they, at one point, they turned their backs on an opportunity to progress into a higher spiritual connection. And DK talks at length about this. I haven't primed myself on this stuff because it's not really part of what we're doing right now. So that's about all I can say on that at this point.
So sorry if it's a little confusing for me, because it seems like some people are allowed to say no and other people, it depends on the context.
There is no allowing. There is no great supreme being who allows anything. It's really just whether you're following the energetic flow or resisting it for other purposes. And then that, those two groups, and then that is translated into language of refusal and fallen, and which makes it seem as though there's an all commanding God that you're breaking the law. It's not that.
Well, this is so essential what you just said, because when we think about the third initiation and coming into the will of God, thy will be done. What you're basically implying there is that not everyone not only has the capacity to do that because the force of the will of God is too powerful, but that we're all in this energetic soup. And so whatever we resist, it could be for our benefit or not for our benefit, but it needs to be for the greater whole is what you're implying, I think.
It's going to get clear as we read along, because that's really the subject of this webinar. So, hold that thought, and I think there'll be a lot of clarity that comes through what we look at today. Okay.
Okay. Well, hold it. Greg had a comment. He says, perhaps for the obedient angels, we might be talking about the stories written in the Book of Enoch, completely different from the rebels.
I can't comment on that because I'm not familiar enough with it. So I'll just plead ignorance on that one.
Okay. And then Tia says, Nicole of the Moyer Federation created an extensive presentation on the Jewish question raised by DK. You may want to reach out to her for more light on the subject.
Okay. Go to makara.us and let's go back to...
I'm not sure we have it on Makara.
Really?
She has her own website with her healing stuff.
Oh, really? Oh, so, okay, I was just going to...
Let me see. Let me look down at the students.
I was thinking in prior webinar series.
Yeah, under...
under the series in progress.
She's got the reappearance of the Christ. She's got the great invocation. And she's got her esoteric healing service group. And a lot more of that stuff is on her website, her her YouTube website.
You know what it's called?
Yeah.
Esoteric. Why don't what I will do is I'll find it and
I found it and I'm ready to put it in the remarks. I'm just
I'm talking about the webinar, and I have Nicole's email. She'd be more than happy. So I'll put it in the chat if you reach out to her to give you access to that information.
Okay, very
good.
Okay, so we then took a look at MPH. Remember, that's Manly P. Hall. MPH's commentary on verse 5, who describes the anthropoids as red men. So this is directly related to what we were just talking about. Not to be confused with the indigenous nations of the Americas. This was his name for this half animal, half man condition, you could call it. HP then reviews the two methods of human incarnation. One, projection by means of the will of the lunar ancestors, the archetypal form aspect into denser planes of substance. So these lunar ancestors literally projected their own image into denser substance. And that's in the first two root races, that's how humanity was created. And then the second method is self-propagation. She then makes a distinction between the idea of fall of spirit into generation and the fall, as put forth by the church, of mortal man. Two very different ideas. We ended our last session with the statement that in order to, quote, become a self-conscious spirit, the latter must pass through every cycle of being, culminating in its highest point on earth in man. So in a way, this comment relates to what's described here, which is that that if this group interfered, man would still be irresponsible and unable to make higher progress. So here, this describes the actual path of how one becomes a self-conscious spirit, which is to pass through every cycle of being, culminating in its highest point on earth as man. Okay, and that's where we left off last time. So let's start today's reading. Can we get a reader, please?
Scott, can you read for us, please?
Sure. Spirit, per se, is an unconscious negative abstraction. Its purity is inherent, not acquired by merit. Hence, as already shown, to become the highest Dhyan Chohan, it is necessary for each ego to attain to full self-consciousness as a human, that is, conscious being, which is synthesized for us in man. The Jewish Kabbalists, arguing that no spirit could belong to the divine hierarchy unless Rosh, spirit, was united to Nefesh, living soul, only repeated the Eastern esoteric teaching, quote, a Dhyani has to be an Atma Buddhi. Once the Buddhi Manas break loose from its immortal Atma, of which it, Buddhi, is the vehicle, Atma passes into non-being, which is absolute being, unquote. This means that the purely nirvanic state is a passage of spirit back to the ideal abstraction of beingness, which has no relation to the plane on which our universe is accomplishing its cycle.
Thank you, Scott. Okay. First, spirit per se is an unconscious negative abstraction. Its purity is inherent, not acquired by merit. This is a fundamental tenet of theosophy, but I would change the wording a bit, for the term unconscious suggests beneath the threshold of consciousness, whereas spirit stands in a position, I wrote here, beyond consciousness altogether. It's not a further stage of consciousness. It has nothing to do, that can be misleading. Consciousness takes you there, but spirit in and of itself is altogether other than even consciousness. So in that sense, it's un, meaning not conscious, in the same way that, or not participating in consciousness. Consciousness is the road we take to get to an ever-increasing awareness of the influence of spirit, but it's not spirit itself. The same can be said about the term purity, which suggests a state or stage beyond the impure. But again, the idea of purity applies only to the vehicle, whether human or logoic, not to spirit itself, which transcends the duality of pure and impure. This is why HPB says that spirit cannot be acquired through merit. For though merit purifies our vehicles, it does not in and of itself take us into the realm of spirit. Okay? Next. Hence, as already shown, to become the highest Dian Chohan, it is necessary for each ego to attain to full self-consciousness as a human, that is, conscious being, which is synthesized for us in man. Unlike in DK theosophy, where the term ego means the soul, in first generation theosophy, ego can represent any one of a number of stages or vehicles. It's, you know, its origins are in the idea of the egg ego, right? From the elemental to the divine ego, used by the indweller on its path of return. So it can be confusing if you have this idea that every time ego is said, it's talking about, you know, either the personality ego or the soul. In this passage, HPB uses the term to represent the indwelling jiva, who must at some point move into and through the human kingdom in order to become self-conscious, which then leads to an ever-expanding synthetic inclusion by graduating through a series of the egos shown here. Okay, next.
Francis?
Yeah.
Sorry, we got a couple of comments here. Tia has put Nicole's presentation, the link for the series,
great,
in the chat. And then Magda says, Enoch angels are called the watchers, the guardians, which is an ascended patriarch. More than the three books, Vigilantes series, very esoterically relevant is the book, The Keys of Enoch. Enoch was father, he says, I think, to Methuselah, biblical figure, and considered the master of all masters, Lao Tzu, Buddha, Zarathustra, Steiner, Ivanov, etc.
Okay, thank you for those chats, additions. So you can pick up that link, copy paste that link, and get to that series on the Jewish problem, quote unquote. By the way, that's one of the reasons that very falsely, Alice Bailey was considered an anti-Semite, is because she delved into this, into what she called the Jewish problem. I see Tia's hand.
Yes, please go ahead, Tia.
I think, and I have to find it in DK, it's kind of eluding me now, but the intelligentsia or the spiritual intelligentsia is inextricably linked to the Jewish community group. So, I mean, all of us have that connection if we consider ourselves part of the intelligentsia. So you'd be hating yourself, basically, if you took a negative view of any particular group, but, the Jewish group specifically.
Thanks for that clarification, Tia. Okay. So next up, the Jewish Kabbalists, arguing that no spirit could belong to the divine hierarchy unless Ruach, spirit, was united to Nefesh, living soul, only repeats the Eastern esoteric teaching. Actually, a spirit belonging to the divine hierarchy is by definition manifest. Such manifestation always requires both, in Jewish terms, Ruach and Nefesh. Always the spirit in the in its pure abstraction and the vehicle of that spirit. In first generation theosophy, it was Atman and Jivatman, right? Pure spirit, unbound, you could say, an essence, and then Jivatman. In both cases, you know, whether looking at it as Ruach and Nefesh or Atman and Jivatman, they both represent the divine breath and that which the divine breath animates. So let's take a look at the Theosophical Glossary's entry on Ruach, here called Ruah. Could we get a reader, please?
Thea, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. Ruah, Hebrew, also Ruach, vital breath, wind, air, very much in the sense that the Greek pneuma means spirit, wind, air, and breath. A breath, exhalation, the rational soul or mind, possessing counsel, purpose, and will. Often confused with the vital principle placed in the breath and with the principle of life. In connection with Elohim, Ruah denotes the rational and purposive mental quality of the gods, the mental breath or power appearing mainly in humans, feebly in animals. It was regarded in Genesis as moving over the chaos at the creation and operating in and through the universe, producing that which is noble and good in man and leading him to virtue. Cosmic Ruah is in many respects equivalent to the third logos of Greek philosophy, a similar meaning implied exceptional soul powers, as in the inspired ruler and the prophet. Hence the prophetic spirit, which was often represented as passing from one person and resting in another. In the Hebrew Kabbalah, Ruach had the same general meaning, equivalent to Budimanus, the Theosophical classification of human principles.
Thank you, Tia. Next, a dhyani has to be an Atmabuddhi. Once the Budimanus breaks loose from its immortal Atma, of which it, Buddhi, is the vehicle. Atman passes into non-being, which is absolute being. It's a little confusing. So let's see if we can figure this out. Atman in first generation theosophy is equivalent to the monad in the Bailey works. With that in mind, HPB here describes basically three stages. The lowest is Buddhi Manas, which from the high perspective of a dhyani, both anchors and imprisons spirit in form. After monadic consciousness is transcended, the Atman then transcends Buddhi itself, freeing itself from its primary vehicle called the Jivatman, and is thus reabsorbed into Atma, the realm of non-being or pure spirit. Decay describes these stages as taking place during a progression from the fourth through the seventh initiations. And finally, we have, this means that the purely nirvanic state is a passage of spirit back to the ideal abstraction of beingness, which has no relation to the plane on which our universe is accomplishing its cycle. the term beingness in contradistinction to being is probably the best word we have for describing pure spirit. But contrary to what HPB here suggests, moving from nirvana to pure abstraction actually requires many intervening stages. For even the one about whom not may be said, inhabits a vehicle which must be eventually transcended. Important here is the statement that, quote, the ideal abstraction of beingness has no relation to the plane on which our universe is accomplishing its cycle. Spirit on its own plane, which in itself is a misnomer because it's totally unqualifiable. It's all pervasive. We are all immersed in it. But when it is untouched by the form aspect, is not bound by any local or even universal cycle of becoming. Spirit doesn't become, and it doesn't participate in cycles of becoming, nor is it bound by the form through which the indwelling jiva is striving. It animates vehicles and cycles, but is not bound by either. It's an important distinction. See a hand?
Yes, could you?
Yes, James.
Thank you. Could you expound a little on the relationship between form, archetype, and matter, physical matter, like atoms?
Yeah, form is a function of the second principle, which is an aggregation of matter, which is best serves the indwelling jiva. So, you know, we are in forms right now in our human vehicles determined by the permanent atoms that were created by the second logoi, or the representatives of the second logoi in combination with the karmic lords, in order to give us a vehicle best fitted to our stage of consciousness. Whereas matter is just that which is drawn upon to create these forms. And then you asked something about the universal, or about the archetype, Well, the archetype for the human form is held by the Manu, M-A-N-U, who represents the ideal potential for the root race that rules over.
Okay. That almost clarifies it. Maybe we're going to be are we going to be talking about this kind of stuff throughout this today's lesson, or?
No, today's talk is mostly about the idea of the two classes of Manasaputras and the fallen ones and that type of thing. You're asking about something else, really.
Okay. Well, what I'm thinking about is, you know, an archetype for a chair is like the abstract idea, and then you take matter, you take wood, and you create a chair with it. So when you say form, I can think of matter and archetype both for form.
Yeah, it means something different in theosophy. And it's what I just described to you, which it's a function of the second principle of deity, not the third. That is, it acts as the architect, and it manipulates matter in order to create form. So the two are distinct from each other in that way.
Okay, I'll wait till I hear more and flesh out the whole thing. So, all right, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Francis?
Yeah.
Steph asks, is there a book chapter that elaborates on the Manu?
Oh, the best thing always to, you know, I'm a big fan of word search, you know, so, you know, you should have some kind of application that allows you to do word search over multiple files. You know, like, for instance, this one right here called Acrobat. This is Acrobat Pro, and it allows you to do. Also, if you have the CD for the Alice Bailey works that is sold by Lucha's Trust, you can do, you can search multiple volumes of the Alice Bailey works, and you know, so you do a word search for Manu, and you'll find out, you'll get more information than by reading a whole section somewhere. I think it's described.
I'm thinking of Initiation Human and yeah. Solar. There's actually not only a description in, I believe, the front of the book where he talks about all the different offices, but also there's a glossary in the back.
That's right. Oh, and also in Letters on a Cult Meditation has a good glossary, but you're just going to get a little bit in both of those. A good double paragraph, maybe in Initiation Human and Solar. And then, but like I say, if you really want to get into it, do a word search for you know, all of Bailey or all of Blavatsky, you know, just pull up the Secret Doctrine and do a word search. That'll also give you a lot of information. I see a hand.
I was just going to say, you can also go on Makara's website and in the search, put Manu, because Michael did a lot of papers and references, because he was really a fan on doing topical searches, topical Absolutely. Study.
That's totally right. If you go, sorry for what's on my screen right now. Let's see. If you go.
Compilations.
Go here and then go. Where
yeah,
is
the
it?
Compilations on Makara.
Here's, yeah. Yeah, right here where my cursor is, compilations, you click that. And then you could click on the M for Manu list to see if he's done one. This is a great source. I tend to forget about it. It's really good. There isn't one. There isn't one on this. It's, you know, here's where I'm actually looking, say over here on the left column. Unfortunately, there's not one on Manu, but there often is an existing compilation on a subject. So it's a great resource.
Francis?
Yeah.
There's one hit on the compilation. I do the Control F and look at the whole page, and it says it's under the H, Hierarchy - Manu.
Oh, good. Okay. All right. So under H then. H-I, Hierarchy - Manu. Okay, there it is. So, yeah, see, you probably saw that. Okay, here's the, I've got a limited screen view here, so I'll just move it over. See here, Hierarchy - Manu. And so I just downloaded that, and then you click on your download, of course, and you get the file. Anyway, let's get back. An excellent resource, that compilation section of makara.us. Probably even better than a word search, because basically what Michael did in his indefatigable way, you just can't believe how much stuff this guy did, is he did word searches, and then he basically chose the more relevant, more useful results.
I would like to add that he had help in that. There were a number of helpers who did those compilations.
Thank you. Yeah. Good to know.
A number. Zach, Kay, Vic. I think most of them have the name of the compiler, but Michael asked them to do it, yes.
I see. Okay. That's good. I didn't know that. Okay, let's see. Okay, next up, section B, looking here, section B of this little short verse, which references the middle section of verse 6, quote, they will be born in the fourth race, suffer and cause suffering. Could we get a reader, please?
Vivian, can you read that for us, please?
B, the curse is pronounced, does not mean in this instance that any personal being, God or superior spirit, pronounced it, but simply that the cause which could but create bad results had been generated, and that the effects of a karmic cause could lead the beings that counteracted the laws of nature and thus impeded her legitimate progress only to bad incarnations, hence to suffering. C. There were many wars refers to several struggles of adjustment, spiritual, cosmical, and astronomical, but chiefly to the mystery of the evolution of man as he is now. Powers, pure essences, that were told to create, is a sentence that relates to a mystery explained, as already said, elsewhere. It is not only one of the most hidden secrets of nature, that of generation, over whose solution the embryologists have vainly put their heads together, but likewise a divine function that involves that other religious, or rather dogmatic, mystery, the fall of the angels, as it is called.
Thank you, Vivian. Okay, first, the curse is pronounced does not mean in this instance that any personal God, personal being, God, or superior spirit pronounced it. There is no personal curse pronouncing God. Why it's described as a curse is explained in the next statement, but simply that the cause which could but create bad results has been generated. So lower mind activity inevitably veils spirit. When humanity's innate spirituality was eclipsed by its intelligence during the third root race, let me say that again. When humanity's innate spirituality, because there was a natural spiritual connection all through the first part of the round, because mind had not been developed. But once mind and the intelligence that comes with that began to be developed, it naturally draws a veil over one's awareness of their innate spirituality. And that happened during the fourth subrace of the third root race, which was an event concurrent with humanity's incarnation onto the lowest subplanes of the cosmic physical plane. Personality-based behavior began to arise, behavior that could only, quote unquote, create bad results. Thus begins the path of return, unerringly guided by karma. Again, we have a marked difference between Christian doctrine, which believes in a punishing God, and theosophy, which espouses the self-correcting doctrine of karma. Next, and that the effect of a karmic cause could lead the beings that counteracted the laws of nature and thus impede their legitimate progress only to bad incarnations, hence to suffering. As a result of the gift of mind, human beings entered into the realm of karmic cause and effect. The lesser lords of karma, those that work with the retributive karma or retributive karma, began their work, counteracting the laws of nature and thus impeding her legitimate progress is an apt way of defining sin or error. Though this does beg the question, isn't the human kingdom and thus all of its activities a part of the natural unfoldment of the laws of nature? And if so, don't these laws include humanity's inevitable transgressions and the ensuing karmic effects? Or do these laws represent an ideal by which the lords of karma measure our degree of transgression? Next.
There were many ways refers to several struggles of adjustment, spiritual, cosmical, and astronomical, but chiefly to the mystery of the evolution of man as he is now.
Okay, thank you. This is a huge topic, right? There were many wars. Huge topic. In fact, it's the subject of a lot of volume 2 of The Secret Doctrine. And it could fill several volumes. And in fact, is addressed at length in HPB's writings, all through her writings, including the collected works. But for now, we'll have to settle for this passage from a bit further in The Secret Doctrine. Could we get a reader? Notice this. Yes. Illustration that depicts the war in heaven going on here. There's a little, you have to kind of focus in to see it, but there's a kind of battle going on here. Go ahead.
Okay. Martha, can you read us about the war in heaven?
Certainly. The great wars in heaven in the Puranas, the wars of the Titans in Hesia. In Hesiod and other classical writers, the struggles also in the Egyptian legend between Osiris and Typhon, and even those in the Scandinavian legends, all refer to the same subject. Northern mythology refers to it as the Battle of the Flames, the sons of Mushpel who fought on the field of Wigrid. All these relate to heaven and earth, and have a double and often even a triple meaning. An esoteric application to things above as to things below. They relate severally to astronomical, theogonical, and human struggles, to the adjustment of orbs and the supremacy among nations and tribes. Struggle for existence and the survival of the fittest reigned supreme from the moment that cosmos manifested into being and could hardly escape the observant eye of the ancient sages. Hence, the incessant fights of Indra, the god of the firmament, with the Asuras, degraded from high gods into cosmic demons, and with Vritri or Ahri, the battles fought between stars and constellations, between moon and planets. Later on incarnated as kings and mortals. Hence also the war in heaven of Michael and his host against the dragon, Jupiter and Lucifer Venus, when a third of the stars of the rebellious host was hurled down into space, and quote, its place was found no more in heaven, Secret Doctrine 1. 202.
Thank you, Martha. Thoughts or questions about this? You know, this is just a sample of how this allegory plays out in and it mentions a couple of the civilizations or disciplines that use the analogy of the fallen angels, of the of the Asuras in a battle with the Asura. I see hands.
Yes, I'll hear your soul voice. Please go ahead.
Thank you. If I may ask, in this passage, they relate severally to astronomical, theogonical, and human struggle to the adjustment of orbs. My question is about the orbs. What is that we should understand as orbs in this context?
Well, for instance, there's one mythology that talks about the struggle between Saturn and Jupiter, which represents really the, like in the Greek mythology, the old mythological symbol, hierarchy represented by Saturn, and the new mythology represented by Jupiter slash Zeus, and this is considered to be a blind for the shift from the third to the second solar system, or you know, or the first in time, the third ray dominated solar system, the previous solar system, to the current solar system, and that's represented through a battle of these two planets, okay. Saturn and Jupiter. That's just an example of how that works.
Thank you. So it's actually related to the esoteric astrology, correct?
Yeah, when you're talking about, this mythology of the war in heaven on cosmic levels, it becomes a metaphorical language for astrological adjustments.
Mm-hmm. Francis, thank you. Yeah. I would like to add, can also connote the circle of influence. You know, an orb is a planet, or it can be considered a circle. So in this particular context, I mean, yes, we have it, of course, in the astrological and astronomical context, but I also think of it as the circle of influence.
Right. Yes. Term orb literally means, the circle of influence of a particular planet, for instance, in aspect to another planet, you know. So, yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. Okay.
And then Ariane has her hand up. Please go ahead.
Oh, I've got a couple of questions at least. So one is that what, considering the astronomical or astrological influences bearing down on humanity, I mean, what is possible with individual destiny, considering these huge forces beating down on humanity, driving it towards war and things like that? So that's the first question. Yeah, sure. Zeus or Jupiter's replacing Saturn, which sounds like a great idea. Saturn is being left behind by the Aquarian influences, perhaps, or something like that. But what about all these other forces, some of them that are not very evolved, pressing down on humanity? And how is that conveyed here? Or where does that, how is that illuminated here?
Well, the fundamental opposition is always spirit and matter, you know, which when you confine it a little bit to the human struggle, it's soul and personality. And the goals which are in conflict, the goals of either of those in conflict. And so what we have right now is a strong demonstration at the end of the Piscean Age of a kind of regressive materialistic influence and potency. Part of it comes through the seventh, through the third ray. But it always happens at the end of an age. You know, at the beginning of the age, this was a useful energy, but at this point it is, it's regressive and is hindering our movement into Aquarius. But in dealing with it, we gain consciousness of what needs to be overcome. And we draw on or call out to the spirit aspect. And, you know, the question is, at the end of the day, who wins? Ultimately, it's always spirit. You know, will this root race fail? It's totally possible. You know, the last two have failed. Both the Atlantean and the Lemurian root race ended early. Because they had to be cut off because the negative influences came in. That might happen again, but you can't stop humanity. It just means that there's a delay.
So what happens to us if it fails? I mean, say we are not able to graduate. What happens to humanity? Does it just go into like this holding pattern and we're not allowed to continue evolving for a period of time, like in Pralaya or something, like in something like that, limbo? What happens to us if that should happen?
Well, I think you can look at it. I understand your question. Yes. I think if you look, you can look at humanity as a whole, and then you can look at each individual members of humanity. And certainly karma continues, spiritual awakening or lack thereof continues when we pass onto the other side. You know, DK says, not all that much changes. You know, I love the little story that Ram Dass tells about he contacts this quote unquote trustworthy spirit from the other side through an acquaintance of his, and so he's asking that spirit from the other side about death, and the spirit says, well, the first thing that you should know is that it's perfectly safe. Death is perfectly safe. And I always love that, you know, because it doesn't stop. You know, we really are prejudiced towards being alive, aren't we? You know, pretty natural prejudice. And it's really hard, in spite of the teaching, to imagine that there's a continuation. So if, you know, if our environment is temporarily, I even hesitate to say destroyed, temporarily greatly changed, then it may be that many, many fewer people are able to incarnate. But guess what? That's what happened after Atlantis. There was a flood. The fourth root race was destroyed. There was a seed group that traveled all over the world, some of them to places around the Mediterranean, others to England, a significant group into Central America, and started new cultures, which is the embryo of the fifth root race, you know, significantly in India, and the those who carried the seed of the new. And I don't see any reason the same thing wouldn't happen again, except for this time it'd probably be destroyed by fire rather than by water. So that's the prediction. So there would be a time of a great lessening of incarnation. You know, there would be maybe 1% or 3% or something of in terms of numbers. But the progress would continue. You know, maybe there'd only be certain inhabitable regions for a time until the physical planet righted itself, healed itself. And this is just speculation. You know, I'm not quoting DK here. This is something I've thought about somewhat. And you can't, the point is, we don't die as a result of physical plane annihilation, right? And we also don't necessarily go into a limbo. There will be those who will find no opportunity in the new phase and will have to wait until another opportunity comes for them to progress, and others who will find immediate opportunity to advance. I would think that it would be the beginning of the sixth root race, or maybe just the sixth sub-race of this fifth root race, that would then survive and go on in much smaller numbers. Those are just some thoughts I have about it. Okay, anyone else?
Okay, and then I just want to make a comment about orbs. Could I add just one comment about the orbs, which is important and relates to karma, and as a response to what was said before with Helos and stuff. So I took this class with this woman who was
taking photographs of light, you know, orbs of light, just using an LED and her some super duper digital camera. And all these different orbs, fully formed circles with different patterns, were appearing, and they were responding to both vibration and sound, like music and such. And her name is Diane. Her videos on YouTube of these orbs. And what I understood from them is that when we think about karma, that not only like Masaru Emoto's work, where he took photographs of melting water crystals, like snowflake patterns, responding to vibration, prayer, and sound, but not only water records vibration, but light or orbs of light are recording that. And that may be where our karma is recorded as well. So to say that light itself is alive and is responding to our thought and our feeling and our behavior. And just to underscore that, so I was taking this Zoom class with her, and when I went back and looked at the pictures, there's a picture of Jesus that appeared on the Zoom screen from during the class itself on my computer. So the image of Jesus' face instead of one of the orbs appeared as a blessing. So I just share that because I felt like it was not just a blessing for me, but it was like underscoring this understanding that karma is conveyed, the law of karma and the lords of karma are conveying and recording through light, the orbs of light.
Some very interesting ideas there. Thank you. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. We have a comment here from Greg. He typed it a little while ago. I just couldn't get to it. It says, the collective versus the individual, the dweller on the threshold versus the angel of the presence. Yeah. Individual human versus greater humanity unit. And then polarization on all levels, from the most dense expression to the highest expression in the highest planes of developing consciousness.
Thank you. Okay.
And then Helio Soul Voice says, thank you, Ariane. A great point. I am very much involved in the light spiritual phenomenon. It is amazing and a deep subject.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. And there's, it's easy to imagine that, for instance, karma could be recorded in light vibration. You know, it's very much connected, after all, with the permanent atoms, and these are energetic fields. And light exists on all planes of the cosmic physical plane, so, you know, it might play a part in the recording of the permanent atoms. Okay. Just so you know, theogonical means having to do with the origin and genealogy of the gods. That's what this word means. All right. Next up, powers, pure essences that we're told to create, is a sentence that relates to a mystery explained, as already said, elsewhere. Told to create means to be impelled by the logoic word during the involutional phase of a cycle, when the one becomes the seven and the seven become the multitude. And finally, it is not only one of the most hidden secrets of nature, that of generation, over whose solution the embryologists have vainly put their heads together, but likewise a divine function that involves that other religious, or rather dogmatic, mystery, the fall of the angels, as it is called. HPV gives us a description of these beings involved in the process of generation a bit later in the secret doctrine. Can we get a reader, please?
Magda, can you read that for us, please? Did we lose Magda?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. There you go. Okay.
The fourth group are substantial entities. This is the highest group among the rupas, atomic forms. It is the nursery of the human conscious spiritual souls. They are called the unperishable jivas and constitute, through the order below their own, the first group of the first sectenary host, the great mystery of human conscious and intellectual being. For the latter are the field wherein lies concealed in its privation the germ that will fall into generation. That germ will become the spiritual potency in the physical cell that guides the development of the embryo, and which is the cause of the hereditary transmission of faculties and of all the inherent qualities in men.
Thank you. Okay, for further insight into the meaning of the fallen angels, let's turn to this page from Externalization of the Hierarchy. Reader, please.
Okay. Steph, can you read that for us, please? I'm sorry, am I saying your name wrong? Oh. All right, let's go to Michelle. Can you read that for us, please?
Sure. The divine plan of evolution was based upon the production of this relationship between spiritually conscious man and the form aspect. And thus the great law of duality came into action, bringing about the fall of the angels as they descended from their sinless and free state of existence in order to develop full divine awareness upon earth through the medium of material incarnation and the use of the principle of mind. This was the divine plan emanating from the mind of God and swept into activity and progressive unfoldment by the act of his will. At its inception, there took place the original war in the heavens, when the sons of God who responded to the divine urge to experience, to serve, and to sacrifice, separated themselves from the sons of God who responded to no such inspiration, but who chose to stay in their original and high state of being. To this truth, Christ himself bore witness in the story of the prodigal son and his relationship to his elder brother, who had not left the Father's home. Externalization of the hierarchy.
Thank you. Okay.
All right, Francis?
Yeah.
We have a comment from Ann Veronica, and I think it was from like two slides ago. She says, Master DK talks about this tree where the root are up and the leaves are down.
Yeah. Right. And the true roots of our being are, you could say, quote unquote, above us, right? On causal levels, and then the flower of that root occurs on the physical plane. It's a great concept, you know, a great symbol, you could say. Thanks for that, Anne Veronica. Okay, next up, can we, yes, I see a hand.
Could you go back one slide from here?
Yeah, hang on.
Thank you.
Okay, can I go on now?
Yes, please.
Okay. Yeah, this is a cool, old, very old, 1602. Looks like an engraving, maybe, of the sun here leaving his home, and then the sun that stayed behind is over here. Maybe represented here. This may be the father. It's hard to say. Interesting. Anyway, Okay, we're out of time, folks. So we'll pick up here next time with this very bold statement about the nature of Satan. So we'll pick up here next time. Thank you all for participating. Do you have some dates to announce, BL?
Yes, the very next thing is the Treatise on Cosmic Fire on the 26th of January.
This Friday?
Yes. And then the next Secret Teaching of All Ages will be on 4 February. Okay. And then the next Secret Doctrine will be on 18 February. All of these are at 8 p.m. GMT.
Thank you. And there's also a pre-full moon webinar that I'm hosting on Tuesday through MoriaFederation.com, where you can find the link. And then Tuya will do a exact moment full moon presentation on Wednesday. Okay, thank you all. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody. Goodbye.
Thank you.